Thayer versus the Vermont Department of Children et al. Good afternoon. Attorney Hagan, before you start, you have reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. I do want to point out, to the extent the parties are not aware, there was a stipulation the parties submitted to have the Lund Family Center, Inc. Withdrawn from this appeal. That was accepted by this panel just shortly before argument today. I know it was submitted to the court, I believe, on Friday. But that has been admitted, and so officially the Lund Family Center is no longer part of this appeal. Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Colin Hagan on behalf of the appellants. This court should vacate and reverse and remand the decisions of the district court for four principal reasons. First, the district court inappropriately applied Rooker-Feldman to the bulk of the parent Thayer's claims. Second, the court improperly granted summary judgment with respect to the grandparents' claims based on a conclusion that it was the grandparents' burden to go and seek the interstate compact required under the law. Third, the court improperly applied Younger, inconsistent with its decision under Rooker-Feldman. And fourth, the court improperly predicted that the law in the District of Vermont would change based on Virginia law cited by the defendants. This court has been clear for nearly 20 years that Rooker-Feldman does not bar a claim based on an opponent's antecedent conduct, even if that conduct is what ultimately yields the judgment complained of.
So I'm familiar with the Hunter case, the Dorsey case, and all the cases about that conduct that precedes the prior judgment would not necessarily be barred by Rooker-Feldman. But I'm struggling to see how this case is similar to Hunter, because in this case, it seems from reading the complaint that a lot of the allegations in the complaint, if not all of the injury that's alleged, all ultimately stem from the final action, which was the removal of the children from the mother and the termination of her parental rights. So can you help explain to me how this case is similar to Hunter? Because I don't see the similarities. I don't see an independent claim that doesn't stem ultimately from the injury of the removal of the children.
Your Honor, Hunter is highly similar to the facts of this case. First, in Hunter, the plaintiff was complaining of a similar issue of removal of the children. In fact, in that case, the plaintiff was actually seeking to recover the children or reacquire custody of the children.
That's right, and the court found that's barred by Rooker-Feldman. But I thought the claims that were not barred by Rooker-Feldman were the racial discrimination claim, conduct of defamation, and violation of civil rights by conducting unlawful searches and seizures, which we don't have in this case. So I'm trying to understand how Hunter helps your client.
Yes, Your Honor. So what the court did in Hunter was parse the claims very carefully and conclude that even though some of the conduct alleged was barred by Rooker-Feldman, there were, as Your Honor acknowledged, there were other allegations and claims that did not stem from the issue of removal.
So what claims do you say survive when they're looked at in that way here?
Well, the same claims for a constitutional deprivation of a liberty interest.
Let's be clear. The claim that the children are not going to be with the mother is foreclosed, right? Because the state court has decided that. So what are your antecedent claims that you say do not depend on the finding that custody has now been denied the mother under state law?
Well, it's similar to Hunter in the sense that the antecedent conduct...
Just tell me what the claim is. What's the claim that is antecedent and not dependent on the adverse finding about custody?
The claim that that Ms. Thayer was basically forced to accept and forced to undergo treatment that was not required. The fact that the...
And what is the nature of the claim? What right is being violated there?
Well, that's a personal liberty interest that one has.
Okay, so you're saying that she was denied liberty by being required to undergo treatment.
Undergo treatment and accept medication that she did not want to accept or believe was necessary to accept.
Okay, anything else?
Yes, Your Honor. In addition, there was basically the fraud that that procured the judgment. And this court has recognized that, at least in other contexts, when a judgment is procured by misconduct, that misconduct antecedent to the judgment, that's what's complained of, and that is not barred by Rooker-Feldman. So in this case...
And to what extent is it that she gets money damages but she doesn't get the children? Is that what you're suing for, that there was a fraud?
Correct, Your Honor.
Where is that pleaded that you're looking for money damages for fraud?
Well, we don't have a claim for...
Is it fraud on her, or you're saying it's fraud on the court? I mean, I'm not sure she sues for that.
Well, she doesn't have a claim entitled a claim for fraud under common law, but what she does allege, and the district court even acknowledged this, is that she alleges that that even though the DCF knew that there had not been abuse, it continued to argue to the court, and even though it represented to the court that there was not abuse.
That isn't a claim for which she can get any. The only injury she suffered there is the judgment, and you can't challenge that, or am I missing something?
Well, it's true that she can't challenge the judgment, and she's not doing so, but she can challenge the conduct that procured the judgment. And here, the conduct that procured the judgment was...
But this isn't conduct that's separate and distinct from what went on in the court proceeding. That's what I'm troubled by. Basically, you're saying this judgment is fraudulent because these folks lied to the court. Now, the judgment has to stand, but I get what? And I'm not sure I see a case in any event that says that though you're arguing that a judgment was obtained fraudulently, you can sue on that while the judgment still stands.
Well, because what she's claiming is that that judgment was not only procured by false statements to the court, but false statements to her, a lack of notice to her, for example, when the DCF in the court immediately without notice changed the basis for its CHINS action.
Well, what's the nature of the right there? I mean, what did they owe her that she was denied? I mean, I'm not sure that they had an obligation. It's not right that they lied to her, but what's the claim?
Well, she's entitled to notice and an opportunity to be heard before her liberty interests are deprived.
Well, she got notice. I thought you were claiming that the notice she was given was based on false facts.
It's both. She got notice at the court while they're arguing. They go in for a conference with the court under a specific theory that the children are being abused or that they've been abandoned, neither of which were true. When the DCF acknowledged, well, there's not been any abuse, we acknowledge that, but now we're going to change and say that it's based on a lack of her ability to supervise the children under Section C of the CHIN statute in Vermont. That was brought up at the courthouse for the very first time.
Having presided over juvenile proceedings and termination of parental rights proceedings, it is not uncommon for a state to pursue termination on multiple grounds or on one ground and then change the grounds. That's all part and parcel of the process. So even assuming she was wronged and that's not good, that's still the injury she's complaining of, all stems from this proceeding that resulted in the termination of her parental rights. Unlike Hunter, where there's separate, distinct conduct that is not related or dependent on the judgment, like conducting unlawful searches and seizures or, you know, defamation. But I guess I'm struggling to see even the first claim that you mentioned in response to Judge Raji's question, forced to undergo treatment. That's part of the specific steps. When a child is removed and there's an effort to reunify the child with the parent, they're asked to undertake steps, specific steps at rehabilitation, so that they can presumably be found fit. Again, the injury from having to do that would be part and parcel of the proceeding. How is that separate, a separate injury?
Well, as Your Honor pointed out, I mean, the problem with that is that she was told she has to do unspecified things. She was not told exactly, here are the metrics that will be evaluated in order to determine that you're now fit. She's told she has to go do these things, go get treatment, go attend counseling, do those other things. But there's not a specific metric that she was told to understand. If you do X, the result will be reunification with your children. It's a moving target, all based on just changing circumstances that she never has notice of. So that's a distinction from, I believe, what Your Honor is suggesting. But in addition to the issue of being forced to accept treatment, she's also denied, these things are happening with false emergencies. The false allegation of an emergency was also at issue in Hunter. That was one of the claims that I understood, or one of the theories that I understood that the court said, that's antecedent, that's based on the DCF's conduct, or the analogous entity. The judgment didn't cause the DCF's antecedent conduct in Hunter, nor in this case. And so even though there weren't things like police action, well, there was actually. I mean, the DCF gives her housing, and that housing is deemed by the police to be unfit, and so the police come without even notice to her and take the children away from where she's staying. Then the DCF further basically sets her up for failure by putting the children far away where they know she can't get to. She lacks transportation. They take away her transportation and housing services without notice and without any opportunity to seek subsequent services. And so it's those circumstances that constitute the constitutional deprivation that preceded the judgment. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. You have reserved your 2 minutes for rebuttal. I understand Attorney McLean and Attorney O'Ryan, you've split your argument 6 minutes and 4 minutes, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. David McLean on behalf of the Department for Children and Families. I appreciate the court's questioning so far with respect to whether there are antecedent or independent claims in this matter. DCF maintains that there are no antecedent claims or independent claims, and the district court should be affirmed because it very carefully went through the complaint and evaluated the nature of the injuries that the plaintiff is alleging and the damages they are requesting, and determined that for every single count, the plaintiff was indeed challenging the family court's orders and seeking to have them undone.
The district court, though, does say at one point that it is applying a standard, a holistic standard, that is not what this court has now clarified must be applied, and that but for the holistic approach, for in some jurisdictions, the claims for damages might survive Rooker-Feldman. I'm looking at page 29 of the district court's opinion. So is there reason to think the district judge applied the wrong standard, acknowledges that there might be claims, viable claims, if Rooker-Feldman were differently applied, and should we give it an opportunity to do that?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that there is any.
Well, let's take a minute. Do you agree that the district court did not apply the right standard when it viewed this holistically rather than looking at the claims separately?
I believe that it analyzed the claims individually. Even though it discussed the standard, it did go through and analyze each of the counts in the complaint individually and determined that each one would be barred by Rooker-Feldman based upon the nature of the injury alleged. And for the every count in the complaint, it's the same injury that is alleged. The court quotes it, and it is the loss of custody of her children for almost 4 years and the indefinite future. That is for every single count in the complaint. And really, that's what Rooker-Feldman comes down to, is what is the injury that the plaintiff is alleging, and how does that mesh with their causes of action?
Well, let me ask you, for example, the plaintiff claims that she was subjected to disability discrimination as a result of being bipolar. Now, at this point, I'm just accepting the allegations made. Even if there were reasons not to give her custody of children, if disability discrimination informed some of the actions by state officials other than the court, does she have a claim there that survives Rooker-Feldman?
No, she doesn't, Your Honor.
Help me out.
Yes, of course. So the process of the family court consideration of how the children should be handled and reunification or adoption is all mediated through the family court. The family court is responsible for reviewing the case plans and adopting the specific steps that the Department for Children and Families recommends. So in that process, the court is going to be considering whether or not there are any reasonable accommodations or if those reasonable accommodations would pose an undue burden. So therefore, an ADA claim would be something that the court itself has substantively considered. And raising it now would simply require this court to go back and evaluate whether or not the family court did that appropriately. Those are barred. They're different from racial discrimination claims. There is no reasonableness evaluation for what services a person is entitled to based on their race. That is simply wrong, racial discrimination.
So let me be sure I understand you. So you're saying disability discrimination cannot infect a custody decision? And for that reason, it cannot be brought as a separate claim?
I'm not saying that it cannot as a hard and fast rule. In this case, given the nature of the injuries complained of and the complaints that they are making, it does. It is barred.
Okay.
And there is precedent in this circuit for that. I think it's Whatley versus the Department for Children and Families, District of Connecticut. 2019, Westlaw 706-7043, similar result.
And does the same argument pertain to her claim that she was coerced into voluntarily relinquishing her parental rights? I mean, assume, arguendo, that she's got a plausible claim, that she was coerced. Does she have a separate claim, quite apart from the custody claim?
No, she doesn't,
okay,
Your Honor.
Help me out with that one.
The relief for that would be in state court, in an appeal directly to the Vermont Supreme Court alleging ineffective assistance of counsel, coercion. That would be something for the state court to handle. The claim here, if this court were to, or the district court were to try to address it, would directly require review and rejection of the family court's process. The family court had a very detailed colloquy with plaintiff with the termination of parental rights.
But is that so clear? Let's assume that after everything, she was coerced. Nevertheless, the Vermont court, looking at the totality of circumstances, decided the children should not be with this woman, whether she agreed or didn't agree. But that's why I'm suggesting to you that the coercion claim might be separate from the custody question.
Well, I think I see what you're saying, but the nature of the injuries alleged in the complaint are the loss of custody of her children.
Yeah, so that's
so you can't get outside of that in this case.
Is that because in every count, from count 1 to 7, and then the language is repeated in count 8 as well, at the end of each count, there's a statement, loss of custody of her children for almost 4 years and the indefinite future, the physical, emotional, psychological damage resulting from loss of custody, separation, the plaintiff's children, litigation expenses, attorney's fees, all the prayer for relief within each count, the allegation of each count is the loss of custody. Is
precisely.
That right? And when it came to the voluntary termination, I'm assuming, but correct me if I'm wrong, in termination proceedings, a parent can go forward with a trial.
Yes.
Or they can consent to the termination, voluntarily terminate. And sometimes it's an open, with the agreement that it will be an open adoption. There'll be some communication, sometimes letters. Are we talking about a situation here with the advice of counsel, this particular plaintiff went through a voluntary termination, meaning she opted to voluntarily terminate her parental rights and went through a canvas? Typically, the court does a canvas. Have you been advised by counsel? Have you had time to talk to your attorney? Were you forced to enter into this agreement, much like a plea canvas? Did that happen here? Is that?
Yes, absolutely. That happened. So the allegations are that her counsel advised her that she should voluntarily terminate. There was no hope in regaining custody. And if she didn't voluntarily terminate, she would never see her children again, which that was counsel's action. That was not DCF's action. And she did proceed with a voluntary termination. So and the court did go through this colloquy, canvas, as you're referring
and
to
that
it.
That is now the claim is now that that was somehow that that was coerced.
Correct. Correct.
And not truly voluntary.
Correct. Yes, exactly. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Evan O'Brien for John W. Donnelly, PhD. May it please the court. There's a single issue, a single claim on appeal regarding Dr. Donnelly. That's a state law wrongful interference with custody rights claim, which was count six under the second amended complaint. That claim is governed by section 700 of the restatement second of torts, as the district court correctly found. And the district court dismissed that claim on Dr. Donnelly's motion for judgment on the pleadings. This court should affirm. Section 700 speaks of abducting or of compelling or of inducing a minor child to leave or not return to their to the custody of their parent. And there's also a knowledge element as well to Section 700. The sole predicate for this claim was Dr. Donnelly's participation in the state court proceeding that my colleague has described and that the panel is aware of. And his participation consisted as in the role of a mental health evaluator, preparing a family forensic evaluation that was meant to assist the court, the family division court, in doing a best interests analysis. And as Judge Kahn, your dialogue with my colleague just revealed, that trial and analysis didn't ultimately take place because of the consent judgment that followed. But that's the only conduct that was thought to be, or alleged to be.
Although I would imagine the attorney reviewed your client's report and factored that into the attorney's advice on whether she should voluntarily give up her parental rights or go to trial. So you can't say that your client's report didn't have an impact ultimately on the decision to voluntarily give up her parental rights, right?
We didn't get to that stage in the record. So I don't want to say that it did have an impact. I probably wouldn't say it didn't have an impact either.
I'm not trying to put you on the spot to concede that.
Sure.
But my point is when a party in a termination of parental rights, a parent opts to voluntarily give up their rights, they do so mindful of what evidence is likely to be presented against them. And that would include all the evidence, including your client's report. So I'm not sure that it's fair to say he had nothing, absolutely nothing to do with this. The question is whether whatever violation came out of that report, that injury stems from the ultimate judgment to terminate her parental rights or not. That's really the question, I think, one of the primary questions before us under Rooker-Feldman.
Yes, and we did get a dismissal on 12C from the district court that this, even accepting these allegations as true, including what Your Honor has just posited. Accepting that as true, this is simply not actionable under Section 700. And the district court did a very thorough Erie analysis, and there is really no alternative Erie analysis that has been, I think, coherently put as an alternative by the appellants here. Any kind of alternative body of law that could have been used to reach a different conclusion on this particular claim. So the district court got it right on its Erie analysis and prediction, which was, I would submit, was correct and should be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Hagan?
Yes, Your Honor.
You have reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. On rebuttal, two minor points. First, with respect to my brother's arguments as to Mr. Donnelly, the issue with the district court's decision in Donnelly is that the complaint was founded on a prior decision in the district court that Section 700 would apply, Section 700 of the restatement would apply, and that the courts in Vermont had long held that this type of interference with custody was improper.
Have you any case in which they applied this to professionals involved in the custody process?
Not in Vermont, or not under Vermont law, and that's precisely the issue, is because the status of Vermont law at the time the complaint was filed was based on a prior district court decision that the Vermont law would apply Section 700. What happened in this case is that the district court looked to Virginia law to find that that Section 700 would be read narrowly to apply only to things like abduction and coercion and so forth.
So that's not this case. And what the district court noted was that other courts interpreting Section 700 have declined to extend its cause of action to ancillary professionals. And to that end, I believe reference cases out of state that having mental health professionals and guardians ad litem brought into court on these kind of grounds actually is highly detrimental to the whole process. And so the conclusion was that you just don't have a cause of action under Vermont law for this sort of action. So I started by asking you, do you have any case in which a professional has ever been held to account? And I gather the answer is no.
That's correct, Your Honor. At least that would be binding in Vermont or on the district court. Thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both sides. We will reserve decision on this. Thank you.